Requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Join KABU and Kofallin Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is the KABU Evening News. But first, we'd like to take this moment to tell you that KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners just like you, and support from McMenamin's Barley Mill Pub, celebrating its 35th birthday Saturday, June 16th. Filled with the Grateful Dead vibes and artwork, the party will be going on all day. The Garcia Birthday Band will be playing from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. All ages are welcome at 1629 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More details at McMenamin's.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, an outside reviewing agency has given a Clackamas County Sheriff's Department a 59-page report.
We are going to get a World Cup preview that even the most casual of fans can find useful.
A Ugandan inventor has invented a new way of testing for malaria.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, June 14th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Clackamas County's Sheriff's Office has been reviewed by an outside organization after a sergeant-turned-whistleblower named Matt Swanson complained about a detective, Jeffrey Green, who had not investigated an alleged sex crime. Swanson says that not only were his complaints ignored, but his workplace became hostile after he made those complaints. The outside agency, known as the OIR Group, reviewed the Sheriff's Department and found that complaints were systematically neglected, and that there was even further evidence of Detective Green being consistently negligent with his caseload without any reprisals occurring. The agency's 59-page report spares nobody's feelings. It revealed that not only had Detective Green often ignored allegations that would lead to investigations into hefty crimes, such as sexual abuse of children, but would also create evidence in order to hastily close a case. In spite of Green's less-than-stellar work ethic, he had not been investigated since 2013 and had retired in 2015. Sergeant Swanson, who had initially complained about Green, still called for an investigation that would at the very least reveal how someone's gross misconduct could be ignored for so long. Swanson also had to fight to have Green's huge backlog of cases completed before the statute of limitations came up. In the OIR Group's review, they stated that, quote, "One of the striking observations we made during our review of the Green matter is that there has yet been no public pronouncement that CCSO could have handled any aspect of the attendant situation better. Increasingly, law enforcement entities have recognized that it is not necessary to defend every decision, that every organization makes mistakes, and that simply admitting when the agency could have performed better goes far in regaining trust of the community. End quote. As of press time, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department had not stated whether or not it would follow the recommendation.
On June 30th, a Defend PDX rally will be held to demonstrate opposition to a Patriot Prayer rally. The Defend PDX rally is scheduled from 4 to 7 p.m. in Terry Schrunk Plaza. Patriot Prayer is a known alt-right group. Patriot Prayer, led by Joey Gibson, has targeted Portland multiple times as a gathering site for white supremacists and neo-Nazis. On the 30th, Patriot Prayer plans to come back to Portland. According to the Defend PDX organizers, many of Gibson's followers have broken off from his group, but those who that remain have become more and more violent. Some of those remaining are members of a group called the Proud Boys, who serve as a de facto bodyguards for alt-right rallies. Organizers are calling for a sustained campaign against Gibson and his rally. During past rallies, Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys have clashed with anti-fascist counter-protesters. The Portland Police Bureau has been criticized for treating alt-right protesters with more respect than anti-fascist protesters. On June 3rd, at their last rally, the PPB was less forgiving to Gibson and his followers. Gibson claims that many alt-right supporters from outside of Oregon plan to attend the June 30th rally. Defend PDX organizers are calling any and all counter-protesters to attend the Defend PDX rally to demonstrate a united front against Gibson and Patriot Prayer.
On January 8, 2018, Initiative Petition 25 was cleared for circulation in an attempt to bring greater corporate transparency to Oregon. IP 25, if successful, will require publicly traded corporations to share state tax filing statements with the Secretary of State. A failure to share such statements could result in the corporation being fined up to 25% of its gross recipients across the state. Such penalties could be enforced up to $1 million in fines. If IP25 reaches the November ballot and passes, it would ensure that such tax disclosures would be publicly available. Current law in Oregon holds that state agencies are prohibited from gathering and sharing confidential corporate tax information. The measure would reverse this standard and would also require corporations to identify any person or entity owning more than 50% of voting stock in the corporation. Such statements would become public record, at the start of the third calendar year after the tax statement is submitted to the Secretary of State. The measure requires 88,184 valid signatures before July 6, 2018. The measure, if passed, would help raise transparency and accountability of corporations to Oregon voters and would assist legislators to craft pertinent tax policy. According to Tax Fairness Oregon, taxes paid by corporations in Oregon are among the lowest in the nation. Such corporate taxes make up less than 6% of Oregon's tax revenue. By contrast, personal taxes make up 89% of tax revenue. Some Oregon corporations receive millions in grants and tax breaks, while other corporations may receive no breaks or grants. IP 25 aims to clarify which corporations across the state are paying their share of taxes and which are being given too much leniency. The initiative also aims to determine the proportion of every Oregon corporation's tax breaks in relation to its total tax liability. Our Oregon officially supports the initiative, and Tax Fairness Oregon has released a link to the printable petition by email to its readers across Oregon. The petition must reach its signature goal before July 6th, or IP25 will not be on the November ballot.
The Oregon Department of Transportation is holding a hearing soon to consider toll road fees for sections of both I-5 and Highway 205. The tolls are an effort to reduce congestion and raise funds for future construction projects. No specific toll amount or time of day has been discussed. There are currently 5 different proposals being considered, focused on toll placement, lanes of travel, and section of highways to consider. The board is expected to make a final decision on November 16th.
This year, multiple Pride celebrations have been preparing well in advance to keep their marchers and attendants safe during the celebrations. amid fears that anti-LGBTQ trolls will hurt attendance. Reports on Facebook and to the KBOO Evening Newsroom have pointed to a Portland return of Joey Gibson's followers, including the small but violent club, the Proud Boys, during Portland Pride Week. The reports have caused some extra anxiety after the murder of 28-year-old trans woman Gigi Pierce last May, and what seems to be a severe uptick in violent assaults on LGBTQ people in Portland this spring. LGBTQ community members that include Pride organizers in Portland have said they've experienced what seems to be an early start of anti-Pride hate tactics. The KBOO Evening News compiled numbers from its own reports within the last 3 years and saw an increase from the 46 stories our newsroom covered in 2016 on hate crimes and national stories related to white supremacy and anti-LGBTQ movements to 150 stories in 2017. Greater Portland Trans Unity issued two statements on the group's Facebook page since yesterday. Each statement gave Trans March attendants several pointers for staying safe, which included sticking with a partner or group, respecting the march line up, and allowing peacekeepers to be the buffer between march attendants, the police who are mandated to be present because of permitting, and counter-protesters. The statements also suggest having a safety plan that includes writing a phone number on your body in two places if you plan to attend marches and to not let your photo be taken without permission. Pride Northwest, the organization behind the Portland Pride March, issued its own statement regarding safety earlier this afternoon. In the statement it said, quote, Pride Northwest is watching reports of white supremacist groups potentially planning to target our community during Pride weekend. Alarming as this is, it is not the first time, nor is it unexpected, given the current political climate we find ourselves in. The safety of our community is always top priority, and we have been working with the city, our own security people, as well as community partners, to do as much as we can to keep people safe while attending Pride Northwest-associated events, end quote. Both organizations emphasize that whatever people's Pride plans are to avoid ahead and enjoy the festivities in groups.
According to the new Now Next, LGBTQ groups are being excluded from a Provo, Utah 4th of July parade after threats of sponsors backing out if the groups were allowed to participate. Organizers in America's Freedom Festival are now facing heated community backlash and scrutiny from a local lawmaker. Utah County Commissioner Nathan Ivey threatened to pull some of the event's public funding over the decision to bar the five groups: Provo Pride, Provo PFLAG, Encircle, Queer Meals, and Mormons Buildings Bridges. $100,000 had been donated to the nonprofit organizing the event after organizers signed a non-discrimination agreement. That particular agreement happened after Encircle's application was denied before the 2017 parade, after initially being approved. Paul Warner, the Freedom Festival director, released a statement today announcing the five LGBTQ groups could reapply if they can meet the parade's guidelines that all signage and messaging be focused on celebrating America. Warner claimed that the groups had pushed their special interest and agenda in their original applications, and that exclusion was not a sign of anti-LGBTQ bias, pointing to the 22 applications that were denied out of the 120 applicants. He said the festival stands for equality. However, the parade is a 4th of July celebration of America, not a special interest-oriented parade.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agency is set to propose dropping the protections against the gray wolf in the lower 48. Currently, it's illegal to shoot a wolf unless it's threatening a human life. Wolves, historically and currently, are despised by farmers for taking livestock and coveted by trophy hunters. Previously, they were hunted without any protections and brought to the brink of extinction. Under their current status as protected, they have been able to make a steady comeback. Here in Oregon, a mating pair was spotted on Mount Hood. However, this does not mean that population is at a healthy rate. The attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, Colette Adkins, states, quote, Time and again, the courts have told the service that wolves need further recovery before their protections can be removed, but the agency is dead set on appeasing special interests who want to kill these amazing animals, end quote.
A Walmart in Brownsville, Texas has been converted into a facility that houses immigrant children that have been separated from their parents. As part of a policy by the Trump administration, immigrants crossing the border from Mexico into the United States for asylum have been arrested and separated from their families. The change has caused a major increase in the number of children that need to be detained and housed. As official federal facilities are overwhelmed, a company called Southwest Key has turned an abandoned Walmart into a facility that processes and houses almost 1,500 children. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley tried to visit this detention center on June 3rd, but was turned away. After asking to see the condition of the children being detained, a site supervisor, along with police, turned him away. As the makeshift detention center fills to capacity, it is unclear what the next step will be to house more migrants seeking asylum.
New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood has filed suit against the Trump Foundation, accusing it of misusing funds. The suit alleges that rather than being used for charitable uses, it's become used as Trump's personal spending account. Such expenses include decorating his golf courses, paying off debts, a $10,000 portrait of Trump, and campaign events in 2016. The Trump Foundation has no employees, and its board of directors hasn't met in 19 years. Three of Trump's adult children, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka, and Eric Trump, also were named in the lawsuit because they have been official board members of the foundation for years. President Trump has responded to the suit, saying it is baseless and politically motivated.
Climate Connections aims to show not only how climate change affects our lives, but what we can do about it. Here's today's episode.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Annapolis, Maryland, where the Severn River enters Chesapeake Bay, the historic U.S. Naval Academy sits nearly surrounded by water, and that water is rising. John Conger, a former official in the Department of Defense, directs the Center for Climate and Security, a nonpartisan think tank.
Annapolis encounters flooding on a regular basis. This impacts the base today, and it will impact it more in the future.
As seas rise, high tides are expected to regularly flood sections of the academy, and as much as half of the campus could be flooded when hurricanes strike. Conger says the Naval Academy is getting ready. It's purchasing flood barriers for doorways, designing buildings that can better withstand first-floor floods, and repairing seawalls. It's work that must be done if the Navy is going to continue training future generations of officers at Annapolis. Similar problems are emerging at military bases around the world. And Conger says that military personnel are responding.
To the extent that climate change is going to affect how they do their job and whether they can do their mission and how resilient they are, they're going to pay attention to this issue.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Current Cast is produced daily to highlight one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, freshwater contamination due to ballast.
A superhighway for aquatic invaders on this Current Cast. When locks and canals began allowing ocean-going vessels to bypass Niagara Falls, they did more than open new trade routes to the west. Suddenly,
things like sea lamprey and the alewives were able to swim around Niagara Falls and get into Lake Erie and then the upper Great Lakes, too.
Tim Campbell of the University of Wisconsin Extension says other invasive species were carried in by ship.
Things like zebra mussels and spiny water fleas, round gobies, a lot of the really big-name invaders came in through ballast water.
It's easy for new species to hitch a ride on smaller boats, too, and spread from one place to another. So to help slow them down, boaters should clean, drain, and dry their boats between waterways. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
The The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to keep the news honest. On today's roundup, the Clinton emails, deportation, gay pride in Montana, and lead in the drinking water.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, June the 14th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. The DOJ Clinton email probe report due out today. Also on the Thursday rundown, a deportation order deemed a death sentence in Connecticut, lead contamination in school drinking water worse than expected, and the Big Sky State celebrates 25 years of LGBT pride. Topping our news, conservatives on Capitol Hill anxiously awaiting the imminent release of a report from the Department of Justice Inspector General. The Hill reports it will be scrutinizing the law enforcement agency's handling of its investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server. The Hill reports Congress will likely not see the document until shortly before it is made public, with its official conclusions remaining the subject of intense speculation until then. Immigrant rights advocates are calling a judge's deportation order in New England a de facto death sentence.
Nelson Omar Rosales Santos has a wife and children who are U.S. citizens. He has no criminal record, and the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service has approved his application for a green card. He also has type 2 diabetes and is scheduled for a life-saving kidney transplant later this summer. But according to Catalina Horak, executive director of Building One Community, a Stanford-based organization, a judge has ordered his deportation for next Monday, June 18th, to Honduras, a country he hasn't seen in 30 years.
If he goes without having dialysis for more than a couple of days, his health is compromised. And the long-term prospects of him having a transplant done in Honduras are almost non-existent. So it's really a life and death situation.
Rosales Santos missed an appearance in immigration court 30 years ago, which made him eligible for removal. Public officials, faith leaders, and other supporters will be outside Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices in Hartford at 4 p.m. today to speak out against the deportation order. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
And as schools begin the summer break, environmental groups are urging public officials to take swift action to get the lead out of schools' drinking water. Linda Barr reports on a new interactive map by Environment America and U.S. PERG. It shows lead contamination in the tap water of schools throughout the country.
According to John Rumpler with Environment America, schools from Texas to Oregon, New Jersey, and Maine show high levels of lead. He says there's an ever-present risk of contamination in our nation's schools. It's in the water delivery system, pipes, plumbing, fixtures, and in the faucets.
The most fundamental solution to the problem is to get the lead out, to actually remove the lead-bearing parts in the water delivery system so that our water for our children can be safe.
Medical experts estimate that across the country, upwards of 24 million children are going to lose IQ points because of exposure to low levels of lead. Rumpler points out that the fastest and least expensive way to reduce the problem right away would be for schools to install filters that are certified to remove lead on every faucet and every fountain used for drinking or cooking.
As schools break for the summer, environmental groups say it is a great time for lead remediation. Conservationists are warning that riders attached to the Farm Bill making its way through Congress could damage the nation's public lands and wildlife.
After a House version of the Farm Bill stalled last month, the Senate has proposed a bill that would exempt the livestock industry from a series of environmental reviews and public input. Eric Mulvar with the Western Watersheds Project says giving the green light to just any targeted grazing project, for example, could put rangelands at risk for wildfire.
You could end up with some very harmful targeted grazing projects that could actually increase the amount of cheatgrass infestation without even consulting the public about what's going on the lands that the public essentially owns.
Mulvar notes federal law requires that agencies thoroughly research land management issues and involve the public in decisions that affect public lands. But some members of Congress and the White House argue that cutting regulations that burden industry will lead to economic growth and job creation. I'm Eric Galatis.
The House is expected to hold a revote on its version of the Farm Bill before June the 22nd. It includes a rider by Wyoming GOP Representative Liz Cheney that would reopen vacant grazing lands to cattle, even in endangered species habitat. The Senate version could reach the full floor as early as next week.
And finally, Eric Tegadoff reports that June is Pride Month, a celebration of gay communities across the country. In Montana, Big Sky Pride is holding its 25th annual celebration.
It will include events across the city all weekend and a speech from Governor Steve Bullock. A quarter century of Pride in Montana is a big deal, President of Big Sky Pride Kev Ham says, but he adds that the push for equality is still young. The first Pride marches took place after the violent Stonewall riots in New York City in 1969.
One of the things that I think people don't realize is that we're still the frontier. We're celebrating our 25th Pride, which is a great accomplishment for Montana, but you're looking at 1970 was the first time they had the first annual march in New York.
Ham says Pride celebrations in Montana grow every year. Events over the weekend will span the spectrum, from kickoff at the Lewis and Clark Tap Room on Friday, to comedy shows, to a meet and greet with LGBT state legislators at 10 Mile Creek Brewery.
Advocates say they are still fighting for equality, pointing to Initiative 183 in the state, which is currently collecting signatures to appear on the November ballot. It would require people to use a restroom or locker room based on their sex assigned at birth. I'm Mike Clifford, and you've been newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Look inside your tiny mind, then look a bit harder. 'Cause we're so uninspired, so sick and tired of all the hatred you harbor. So you say it's not okay to be gay. Well, I think you're just evil. You're just some racist who can't tie my laces. Your point of view is medieval.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Four Peaks Music Festival. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 50s, followed by more cloud cover and a high in the lower 70s. East of the Cascades in Hood River, the temperature will climb to almost 80 degrees. Today in history, in 1789, the survivors of the mutiny of the HMS Bounty landed in Timor after 47 days on the open ocean. The mutineers went on to settle on Pitcairn Island after making a stop in Tahiti to resupply and kidnap some locals. They eventually burned the ship in order to prevent the Royal Navy from detecting them and to prevent anyone from escaping. The quote of the day is from Ernesto Che Guevara, who was born on this day in 1928. Quote, "Silence is argument carried out by other means," end quote.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Attorneys for the Gila River Indian community defended the Indian Child Welfare Act at a federal appeals court hearing Wednesday. The Goldwater Institute, in a case, is challenging the law, which seeks to keep Native children with Native families. Goldwater claims the law does not protect children from neglect and abuse, but tribes and Native organizations say the law for more than four decades has kept children from being removed from their homes and cultures and from harmful practices by state agencies and child welfare proceedings. In a statement, Gila River Governor Stephen Lewis says, no matter what it takes, they'll continue to fight to protect Indian children and families. Gila River was joined in court by the Navajo Nation. A Cincinnati area high school is keeping its Indian mascot for now. This week, a committee heard debate over the R-word at Anderson High School. Those working to change the name say it's a racial slur, while supporters say it's a school tradition. Supporters showed up to the meeting wearing bright orange T-shirts with the Indian mascot and the words, "Save our skins." Local television news stations report, since the committee could not agree on a yes or no vote, the mascot and team name will remain. The committee was formed to consider changes. The school board has final decision. A nurse who wrongly administered medicine at a Cherokee Nation hospital is no longer employed with the Oklahoma tribe, the Cherokee Phoenix reports. More than 100 patients may have been exposed to HIV and hepatitis C between January and April after the RN used the same syringe on patients. The hospital is currently contacting and testing those involved. Tribal counselors were updated this week by the hospital. The RN's name has not been released. A gathering of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people recently came to a close in Juneau, Alaska. As KTOO's Adeline Baxter reports, the more than 30-year celebration began as an attempt to save culture and has become a reminder that Alaska Native traditions are alive and thriving.
Dancing along the parade route in downtown Juneau, Owen James of Huna pauses to hug friends in the crowd.
It feels great because seeing all these younger generations picking up where we left off, and to see and hear them singing the songs and drumming and stepping up and taking the lead too, it's awesome.
And that's significant, because there was a time when some feared their cultures wouldn't survive. Marlene Johnson said she was reluctant when she first heard the idea to host a cultural gathering for Southeast Alaska Natives, but she knew their cultures needed saving.
It took a long time to get us to the point that we were able to convince the outside world that our culture is not bad. It was a thing of celebration.
Johnson is the chair of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's Board of Trustees. When celebration first began, decades of cultural oppression and government schools had all but wiped out Native languages in the region. Johnson said you never saw children wearing regalia or singing traditional songs in public just a few decades ago.
When I saw those kids yesterday, to see them dancing the way they did, I thought to myself, everything we've done the last 30 years has been worth it when I see that.
Today, celebration brings thousands of people to Juneau. It's become one of the largest gatherings in Alaska. Nearly every community in Southeast is represented on the main stage in Centennial Hall, where about 50 dance groups perform new and traditional songs. As efforts to revitalize Alaska Native languages continue, elders like James and Johnson can take comfort in seeing the younger generation take on a bigger role in celebration each time. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
On today's Trahant Report, the first ever Native American woman won the primary in New Mexico and could be the first ever in Congress.
Deborah Holland won a primary in New Mexico last week, and she is now the favorite to earn a seat in Congress this November. This is Trahant Reports. There have been 12,244 men and a few women elected to the U.S. House, the Senate, or both since March 4, 1789. Yet none of those representatives have ever been a Native American woman, as in ever. Holland is a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo. As she said during her campaign, Congress has never heard a voice like mine. Get the microphone ready. Holland is now the Democratic Party's nominee for New Mexico's 1st Congressional District. She still faces a Republican challenger in November. But there are two factors to consider here. First, it's a district that mostly favors Democrats. And beyond that, this is not a cycle that is working for Republicans anyway. So Holland is now the favorite. There's so much about Holland's win that is worth pointing out. She has worked to build a voter network for a couple of decades, running campaigns for other candidates or the party itself. She did everything right, including pointing out that this country has never in its history elected a Native woman to Congress. I talked to a Latina who told me that she was voting for Holland for that one reason, justice. Of course, the score remains uneven, but more women than ever are running for office, and more Native American women than ever are running for office. 62 by my latest count, and that's just state and legislative offices. More Native women are also running for county commissions, school boards, and, yes, tribal councils. This year alone, there are 4 Native American women who are running for the U.S. House or Senate. So Holland might not even be alone if she's elected to Congress. There are 2 Native women running for governors and 5 more for lieutenant governors. A Native woman is running for Attorney General in South Dakota and Secretary of State in Wisconsin. As Holland said on election night, this is the year of the Native American woman. Another candidate, Paulette Jordan, who is running for governor of Idaho, campaigned with Holland and was with her on election night. Jordan said, "Our political system was not designed to elect women of color, and so we must work harder than anyone else to overcome that culture of political insiders and dark money in order to truly represent the people we wish to serve." Now, imagine what Holland and the other Native women will have to say when they finally hold that microphone on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. I'm Mark Trahant.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day John L. Lewis called miners who worked for Little Steel Coal subsidiaries out on strike. It was an act of solidarity as conditions worsened on steel strike picket lines. The walkout was designed to force the closure of steel mills by stopping the flow of coal. 10,000 workers in as many as 19 mines owned by Republic Steel, Bethlehem Steel, and Youngstown Sheet and Tube dropped their tools. Bethlehem had not been one of the independent steel companies initially included in the Little Steel Strike, but workers at its Cambria Works in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, walked out in sympathy with railroad workers at Bethlehem-owned Blacklick and Connemaw Railroad. They had been refused a contract. Striking miners in Johnstown marched to Cambria Works to join the seven-mile stretch of picket lines. In Ohio, the Canton Federation of Labor voted unanimously for a general strike if the newly formed Citizens League attempted to force reopening of the steel mills. SWAC leader Van Bittner threatened to call out another 600,000 miners by week's end if the strike was not settled. John L. Lewis remarked, quote, "Labor is menaced by the force of arms of Republic Steel Corporation. Labor is calling attention to this situation so the law, government, or public opinion can begin functioning before another massacre takes place." UAW President Homer Martin added, quote, "It is our purpose to spread the light of democracy to every part of this land until autocracy and industrial slavery have been driven from the country." But Johnstown civic leaders and town officials had formed a citizens' committee and prepared for battle as the miners approached. It seemed there was no end to the anti-strike violence. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
A British gay rights activist, Peter Tatchell, was briefly held in Russia after carrying a sign that said, quote, "Putin fails to act against Chechnya torture of gay people," end quote. The small mountain nation of Chechnya has been accused of having gay purges and even holding people in concentration camps. Journalists who have reported on these conditions have been met with harsh reprisals. Chechnya's head of state, Ramzan Kadyrov, not only denies the systematic imprisonment and torture of gay people, but also their existence within the borders of Chechnya. Tatchell, one of the founders of the first Pride Parade in the United Kingdom, will be required to appear in court on 26 June for violating Federal Law 54 and Presidential Decree 202, which prohibit all protests near the Kremlin and during the World Cup. Although he will be leaving the country before his court date, it's expected he will be able to leave without reprisal. As to the conditions of rights and even being able to protest within the Russian Federation, he stated that, quote, "Unlike brave Russian protesters, I have the protection of a British passport, which means I've been treated more leniently than they are. My fate was mild compared to what happens to Russians who dare to challenge the Putin regime. I am awed by their courage," end quote.
This afternoon, Reuters reported on the price-fixing war between the U.S. and China. Reuters reports that the U.S. Washington Supreme Court has ruled in favor of the Trump administration against China. Today's ruling threw out a lower court decision that had allowed two Chinese vitamin C makers to avoid $148 million in damages for violating American antitrust laws. The Chinese government says the two Chinese companies were only following Chinese policy. But U.S. justices ruled 9-1 that the lower court gave too much deference to Chinese government filings. The U.S. justices sent the case back for reconsideration by the New York-based Second U.S. Court of Appeals, which threw out the damages won by two American companies that buy vitamin C back in 2016. Writing for the court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that while U.S. courts should give respectful consideration to a foreign government's interpretation of its own law, they are not bound to accord conclusive effect to the foreign government's statements. China is not official party in the case, but was allowed to present arguments in the earlier April proceedings. Jonathan Jacobson, a lawyer for the Chinese companies, expressed disappointment in the ruling, but said he is confident in prevailing on remand for his clients because Chinese law explicitly compelled price fixing of vitamin C during the relevant period, he said, as our own U.S. government has made clear.
Malaria is the leading cause of death in Uganda. For 24-year-old Ugandan Brian Gita, three malaria blood tests failed to identify his own case of malaria. According to the BBC, in response to this medical failure, Gita became determined to invent a way to diagnose malaria without drawing blood. Gita's invention, called matibabu, which means treatment in Swahili, involves simply shining a beam of red light on the finger of a patient. The beam of light detects differences in color, shape, and concentration of red blood cells in the finger, all of which are telltale signs of a malaria infection. Gita's matibabu was awarded the Royal Academy of Engineering's Africa Prize, which pays $33,000 and represents an opportunity for Gita and his team to gain partnerships, which Gita claims is what we need most at this moment. Matibabu will face extensive testing and research before it can be brought to market. Gita and his team are writing an academic paper on their results and are now receiving international support from researchers to perform field trials. Africa Prize for Engineering Innovation Judge Rebecca Enon Chong claims that, quote, matibabu is simply a game changer. It's a perfect example of how engineering can unlock development, in this case, by improving healthcare, end quote. The majority of global deaths from malaria occur in sub-Saharan Africa. According to the World Health Organization, in 2015, sub-Saharan Africa was the site of 90% of global malaria cases, as well as 92% of global deaths from malaria. Gita explains that the process to prove the viability of his invention is, quote, not an easy journey because you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the device is safe for human use, end quote. If Gita can prove the device's safety and function, it could revolutionize how quickly and reliably millions of people can be screened for the disease.
The World Cup is a spectacle like no other. 32 nations compile the most talented players from around their countries to compete for soccer's highest honor. After 64 matches are played over the course of the coming month, soccer's world champion will be crowned. For the casual fan, the group stages may be a difficult strait to navigate. There are three matches each day, and it can be difficult to discern which to call in sick in order to watch. To guide fans through the first weekend of World Cup matches, KBOO has compiled a list of the most anticipated matches between now and Monday. All matches will be broadcast on Fox or Fox Sports 1 in English and on Telemundo and NBC Universo in Spanish. On Friday at 11 a.m., Spain and Portugal, two of the tournament favorites, will face off. Portugal's Cristiano Ronaldo and his supporting cast will look to take down the well-rounded Spanish side. Look for individual brilliance from Ronaldo and for intricate passing from Spain's many talents. For those willing to brave the early morning and those who can record games on TV, Argentina versus Iceland on Saturday at 6 a.m. will be very fun to watch. Iceland captured our hearts in the European Championship in 2016, and the nation of just over 300,000 shocked us all again by qualifying for the World Cup. Lionel Messi, like Cristiano Ronaldo, is one of the greatest players in history, and his Argentinian side is stacked with attacking talent. This will be a tough task for Iceland, but we have seen wilder upsets before. This Iceland team is not known for throwing in the towel.
At noon on Saturday, Croatia and Nigeria will go toe-to-toe. Neither side is expected to go far in the tournament, but Maestro Luka Modric leads Croatia's stacked midfield. With Modric in the midfield and plenty of talent in attack, Croatia can create changes at goals out of nothing. Nigeria's deadly attack, including Victor Moses, Alex Iwobi, and Kelechi Iheanacho, will definitely cause trouble. This match might fly under the radar, but it's worth a watch. On Sunday, Germany versus Mexico at 8 a.m. is another game worth watching. Reigning champions Germany has too many superstars to count, but the most talented Mexican team in years has been notoriously tough to beat recently. Finally, on Monday at 8 a.m., Belgium takes on Panama. Belgium has an arsenal of attacking talent and will be a joy to watch against a Panama team that will be stubborn defensively. Expect most of the action to occur around the Panama goal. We've waited 4 long years since Brazil in 2014. Now is our chance to sit back and enjoy.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Steve Oster and CJ Fritz. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zello Celis-Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Positively Revolting. Ani takes your calls. At 9, it's Veterans Voice Radio. Northwest Veterans for Peace deal with the health issues and after effects of war. At 10, Valley Views talks to the program director of the Corvallis Bike Collective. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, On the Ground Radio, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Four Peaks Music Festival in Bend, Oregon is a huge kaleidoscope of different music experiences. With two stages and a Kidlandia section, the festival is taking place June 21st to 24th, and it's an event not to miss. We have on the line Stacy Koff, the owner of Four Peaks Presents. Stacy, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us today. Is this for the festival a traditional event? Has it been going on for a long? How long?
This is year 11, actually, but our second year on this new site.
What kind of music are you going to be having there?
We are kind of an eclectic mix all over the board. It started out as kind of bluegrass. We've got bluegrass, Americana, rock, folk, funk, Green Sky Bluegrass is headlining. Not Going Medicine for the People are also headlining Friday night. So it's kind of all over the board.
Give us an idea of some of your top top groups in bluegrass, for example. Who do you got?
Right, so Green Sky Bluegrass headlining Saturday night. We also have the Brothers Comatose from San Francisco doing a late night set on Saturday night. Poor Man's Whiskey, another California band. We've got Cascade Crescendo, Portland's very own, this year. And then Molly Tuttle, who won kind of the guitar of the, or woman guitar of the year award. So that's really exciting. And bluegrass guitar music, too.
Do you have any dance floor out there?
Oh, yeah, just slightly. We have lots of dance floor. We have so much space to dance and roam around. We've got the Cascade Mountain stage, which is kind of the bigger outdoor stage on tons of acreage. And then close proximity to that is the Lava Rock stage, which is like a 120-foot-long tent and room to roam around outside of that, too, and tons of kids running around dancing as well.
And, Stacy, what about food vendors? What can we expect by way of tasty food?
Well, yeah, you know, what's nice about Four Peaks, as well as some other festivals, of course, but when you have a multi-day camping festival, you've got a bunch of food vendors there and beverages. So this year we have over 8 craft local Ben breweries, 3 ciders. We have Hum Kombucha on tap, Bledsoe Wine, Deschutes Brewery, and Cascade Alchemy are doing a second bar this year. So we've got spirits on tap. And then food, we've got Josh Mexican to healthy raw stuff to Thai flavors, coffee, tea, Blue Lotus chai will be there. You know, just everything, actually. Tacos, pizza, and late night stuff as well.
Hi, so Stacy, for anybody new to multi-day music festivals and looking to try this out for the first time, what would you recommend them bringing?
We have, well, on the website, fourpeaksmusic.com, has a kind of know before you go and a packing list type thing. But basically, if you are camping and you're in a tent, you're going to kind of want to bring all the essential camping gear and sunscreen and chairs and blankets and tarps and, of course, your tent and probably, you know, camp equipment. And if you don't, there's also luxury yurts and RVs to rent. So if you want to come in style, you don't have to bring much. But definitely, you know, water bottle. We encourage bring your own water bottle. There's plenty of places to fill up for water. We have silly pints available at the bar because we're a no-waste event, so there's no plastic cups or glass or plastic bottles of water. So, yeah, your own water bottle, tarps, chairs, sunscreen, kids.
So you've been talking about kids. I guess it is kid-friendly. Tell us a little bit about what kids could do.
It is. Thanks. You know, that's one thing that's kind of morphed. The first year we did this, and it kept going. And 11 years later, we're just host to almost as many kids as adults, it would seem. We have Kidlandia area hosted by Hayden Holmes this year, and they're bringing out a play structure for the kids to be in and decorate and do art projects. Corn pools, prayer flag making, tons of workshops for the kids, musicians, juggling, tight ropes, jump ropes, hula hoops, all kinds of stuff. And it's an intimate venue, so the parents can feel good about just kind of letting their kids, of course, age appropriately, roam the venue and run around. Very safe. Over 500 kids were there last year. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of a family tradition for a lot of people. And there's a quiet area if you want to camp in that area as well.
You're not going to sell those unruly kids, are you?
Oh, we could. You know, we've only sold a few in the past. But
hey,
like the sign says, we give them a latte. And
I know. Yeah, we'll give them a candy bar and can
right.
bring them home. I don't know whether to bring my tent or my camper. What should I? Do you have facilities for both kinds of camping, and what else?
We do. We have lots of RV passes, trailer passes, which include, you know, like pop-ups and teardrops. We have tents coming, tons of tents, you know, other pop-ups to deck out your camp with shade. That's one thing I forgot to say, when you know before you go, bring shade. And so there's, yeah, anything goes. You just need to purchase the appropriate vehicle pass if you or bring in a larger size vehicle, but pretty much anything from tents to 40-foot RVs.
And Stacy, do you have any other events going on there besides music?
We do. You know, the main event, of course, is the 2 stages for music, but out in the Junction area, it's kind of a jam area, so people can feel free to play music out there. There's some teepees. There could be a solstice ceremony or two. There's yoga every morning. There's a silent disco on Friday and Saturday nights. And then at 10 o'clock after the main stage, the Cascade Mountain stage is done with the music, there's a movie under the stars for all the family. So we do show 2 kid-appropriate movies at night. And, you know, just the basic beverages and food activities as well, if you can include those as activities. And then there's, of course, the music and dancing.
You didn't say there's a silent disco, did you?
I sure did. I think we're going on year 5 with this, and it seems to be the highlight for so many people. It's pretty fun.
And what do you do at a silent disco?
You basically dance with headphones on, and if the from the outside in, if you're just kind of looking in on it and you don't have headphones on, it's absolutely hysterical, and you see tons of people dancing to essentially the same beat. And there's 3 different channels, so you can program, or you can have headphones on, and there's 3 different channels depending on the music you like, and you just dance, and people hoot and holler sometimes, but it's mostly silent. And it's absolutely a fantastic thing to do, and just cut loose, and you know, the saying, like, dance like nobody's watching.
I've never heard of that before, Stacy. It sounds great.
Amazing.
And I've
amazing.
Never I've never been to Bend. It says this is in Bend. Are you part
it
of are you a private entrepreneur, or are you part of the city, or who's doing this? What's the organization?
Yeah, no, actually, every year we have to get a permit from the county, from Deschutes County, who grants us a permit every year to have this mass gathering on private property, and it's at the Stevenson Ranch, and they've got about 150 acres that we use. It's a 200-acre, basically, private ranch. So it's only 5 or 6 miles out of downtown Bend. So it's right in town. A lot of people even ride their bikes, which we encourage. And it's right in town, and it's private property.
And how much are tickets for this?
They range. So kids 10 and under are free, always. And camping is included with every ticket, but you don't have to camp. We have a young adult pass for $70 that's ages 11 to 18, and then the main weekend pass right now is $200, and that includes all 4 days in camping. And then we do still have a very limited amount of day tickets left that also include the night before in camping. So Friday and Saturday passes are $110.
With 150 acres, it doesn't sound like you're going to run out of room.
You know, we do have plenty of room for people to spread out a little bit more than before. Our last property was only 17 acres, and so we really just outgrew that, and so we have room for things like teepees and pop-ups and luxury yurts and tons of RVs and trailers. So yes, there's plenty of room to camp and spread out.
I just wanted to get back to for a moment to the main point of this, which is the music, at least in my experience anyway. Do you have any groups that keep coming back and are favorites that you're looking forward to seeing?
The return people, we get a couple here and there that return. The main staple that kind of returns every year that's our house band is Poor Man's Whiskey from San Francisco. We did have Green Sky Bluegrass in 2013, and we had Brothers Comatose once or twice before, and those 3 bands are just amazing, and they never get old, and people love to see them, and I love that Poor Man's Whiskey gets to return every year. But mainly we do new bands each year. You know, there's about 23 this year, and 20 of them are new.
Do you have any of our favorites from Portland who will be appearing?
We do. Well, like I said, Cascade Crescendo's coming. Scott Pemberton is coming. And so, you know, they get tremendous play around Portland. I hear they're getting even better all the time, playing more venues, and just people really love them. So we're glad to have them on our stage for the first time this year, both of them.
Wow. Sounds really good, Stacy.
You guys come.
It's this weekend, is that right?
Next weekend.
Excuse me,
June 21st to 24th.
There you go. Make sure I say this correctly. Yeah. It's June 21st to 24th. It's at the Stevenson Ranch, 5 miles outside of Bend, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And prices are reasonable, and the music sounds terrific.
What's the website?
Yeah, thanks.
Go ahead.
4peaksmusic.com is the website. So number 4 and then peaksmusic.com. And everything you need to know is there. And yeah, it actually is one of the most affordable festivals around, I must say. We haven't raised our prices too much in these years.
All right, Stacy, it looks like we're running out of time. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you out there.
Thank you, Stacy. Bye now.
Okay.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archive contractor for 40 hours a week for $20 an hour. This is a contract position that will last from July through December of 2018. The archive contractor will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms. They will work with historical KBOO content in many audio formats, as well as the Resource Space Archival Database, documents of KABU history, and KABU staff and volunteers. Please send in a resume, cover letter, and answer the question, why is KABU important, to del@kboo.org. That's del@kboo.org. More information about responsibilities and position requirements can be found at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KABU is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KABU's history.
KABU, I really think, is a good resource, and they give a voice to people who might be isolated or disfranchised. I thought that was good, how they put it in the mission statement.
KABU was a lot of activity, and I was struck by the diversity. It was very welcoming, and I thought, this is something I like to be involved with.
The day I walked in, it was during pledge drive, and I was immediately pulled over to the membership drive table, which was in the front lobby, and we were all talking on the air about why you should join KABU. And it was fun.
To hear the stories of people who helped make KABU what it is today, go to 50yearsofkabu.fm and click on KABU Stories Project.
KABU.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell an Indian first then?
Hello, Indian country. How are you doing? Happy Pride. That's right. It is Pride weekend. Well,